This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3609 for Thursday, the 2nd of June, 2022. Today's show is entitled Linux In-Laws SAE Operating System Level Virtualization and Martin's Faith. It is part of the series Linux In-Laws. It is hosted by Monochromic and is about 54 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is an in-depth discussion about jails, containers, religion, and other sorts of confinement.
This is Linux In-Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35 or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs.
This is season one, episode 57, I think.
Okay, sounds good.
Martin, what's your guess?
I'm going to tell you.
61?
57.
No, yes, 57, excellent.
Yeah.
So, Martin, how are things if this is 57 really as an episode of Linux In-Laws?
Well, I don't think the episode number has anything to do with how things are, but yes, things are okay. Here, anyway. Can't say the same about everyone else, but there we are. How are you?
Little Britain still standing?
Standing, floating, whatever you want to call it, yeah.
Okay, fair enough. Things are a little bit dire here because with the war and stuff and people getting crazy about energy, fuel, and all the rest of it.
Well, yes, it has been mentioned that, your country is fueling a lot of it, but... By using the fuel or buying the fuel, anyway.
Yes,
I'm sure that's being
reported. There's a school of thought, and people were recording this kind of late March. There's a school of thought here in Germany, and this is where I'm currently recording this. That essentially, that by buying gas and oil and other fossil fuels, we are financing part of the war. Which, when you think of it, makes sense. In terms of financing it, but rather basically providing the fuel that Martin was referring to. Not happy about it. Neither are the ruling parties. And they're desperately kind of, how can I put this? Scrambling is probably the best word to get out of this quickly. Trouble is, you can't.
No. No, you still can't just magic up some gas from somewhere, right?
But this is not a political podcast about wars or the current situation in Europe, but rather about open source technology. So, Martin, what's the crack tonight, to use a totally Irish expression?
Irish?
Mm-hmm.
Are you sure?
C-R-A-I-F-A-C, yes.
Ah, not C-R-A-C-K, right. Okay.
No, that would be an illegal drug in most countries. Come to think of it.
All right. Yes.
Sorry. For the few non-Irish listeners among the audience, crack, as in C-R-A-I, fada C in Ireland, refers to good times, what's up, as in what's the crack, what have you been doing, what's happening, that sort of thing. Details maybe in the show notes or not.
Fair enough. Yes, so tonight's episode is all about
learning Irish. Yes. Sorry, no, Irish. No, it's not about learning Irish. Although, many listeners may be tempted. Details, certainly in that case, will be in the show notes. Joe Crean, if you're listening to this year episode, I'm only joking. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
So is Irish a language or is it Gaelic?
No. Oh, okay. If you had hope to listen to an open source podcast, people forget about it. This is season one, episode one of the Celtic Languages of Europe podcast. Yes. So let me educate Martin, my cherished co-host, about the Celtic languages that have been spoken in Europe and to some extent are still spoken in Europe. Mm. Essentially, as probably some listeners may know, the Celts, an ancient race of many peoples, long gone, brought to a certain extent, let's put it this way, brought a couple of languages to Europe, contrast to the Germanic family of, Germanic languages and also Latin-Roman languages?
Yeah,
Is that the word I'm looking for? As in Romanic languages, sorry, that was the term. Okay. So, the Celtic language is essentially still spoken today, or Irish, Scottish, Manx being revived, Cornish also being revived at the moment, and something called Breton.
What about Welsh?
Plus Welsh, yes.
Okay. Don't forget the Welsh.
Of course, Cornish being feverishly revived. There's a lot of money being poured in Cornish at the moment because this is the latest addition to the Gaelic, to the Celtic languages, or family of languages rather, that have almost become extinct. But fair enough, some people decided that this is worth maintaining, so they put a little bit of money in it, and now you have quite a few people in Cornwall actually reviving the language, I think, which is good news. Mm. And of course, probably the two biggest parishes in terms of Celtic languages being spoken in Europe would be Irish, as in the Celtic dialects being spoken in Ireland, as in mostly the Republic. Of course, Northern Ireland included in certain parts of it, and also Scottish, I suppose. And next comes, I reckon, really Welsh.
Yeah.
What about Breton?
Hmm. Very good.
There is. What about Basque, Martin? Is that a Celtic language too?
Ooh.
Details maybe the show.
I don't think so. But as this is Spain, France region, isn't it? Yeah.
But you see, the Celts had one important trait. They procreated wherever they saw fit. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
So that brings us nicely of the first episode of season one of the Celtic Languages podcast.
Celtic Languages, yes. How many episodes are there going to be?
We do not know.
Okay, fair enough.
People, if you want to have more episodes like this, as in really short ones, please do send feedback to either feedback@CelticLanguages.eu or something called feedback@LinuxInlaws.eu. Yes. Both email addresses, especially the second one, may work.
Oh, surely we have a general catch-all email.
Yes, that would be Martin Visser at.
Yeah,
hero.gov as in hero.government.
Very good.
Back to today's topic. Yes. Namely, operating system virtualization, affectionately known as containers.
Well, yes. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. It's not entirely strictly the best definition, is it? But yeah.
So go ahead, Martin, enlighten us.
Well, the container concept is exactly as the name implies, a thing to shove things in and move around, right? So that's the whole kind of, let's call it the idea behind containers, is that you can take it, move it, run it anywhere. It always has the same content. You don't have to, and it's all self-contained rather than relying on dependencies outside of the container. Whereas Virtualization is more about making efficient use of resources.
Excellent. Yeah. That brings us to the end of that episode. Thank you for listening, people.
And what is your perspective?
That's a rather short one, but we do like short episodes. Yes. No, jokes aside. Yes, Martin, I think you have it spot on. The main difference, the main difference between operating system virtualization and hardware virtualization is, of course, that the hardware virtualization essentially brings to the table a full operating system kernel. And this is the main difference between operating system virtualization, as the name implies, and hardware virtualization. With operating system virtualization, each and every container, whatever you want to call it, or confinement is probably the best term to describe this in a rather generic way, has its own so-called user land, as in libraries, applications, you name it. In contrast, hardware virtualization carries the burden, for want of a better expression, of a full-blown kernel running on top of a so-called hypervisor. Meaning that in addition to the user land, also the kernel as such, as in itself, it's virtualized, including the hardware layer running beneath the kernel, because that's exactly one of the main functionalities of the hypervisor, to abstract away of the physical hardware and to provide the guest operating system running these user lands with a virtualized view of the underlying hardware. That's exactly what hypervisors do, like Xen, KVM, VMware, you name it. In contrast to this, operating system virtualization has a common kernel upon which user lands run, so-called containers, jails, whatever you want to call it. The whole thing is not new. It goes back at least to early instantiations like BSD jails, Solaris zones.
Yeah, I remember Solaris zones. That was
eighties or nineties, right?
Yeah, 90s, early 2000s, I think, along those lines.
Yeah. Details made in the show notes. But the thing is that some people consider Changeroot actually to be the first instantiation of a minimal, let's put it this way, operating system virtualization. In terms of Changeroot, essentially says, here's a directory tree, and with that directory tree, you have your own user land. So if you do a Changeroot, give it a path, and then give it an executable, the kernel will spawn that executable inside path, which better be a full-blown user land, because otherwise you will have problems.
Right.
Meaning, in that case, you have simply pivoted, for want of a better expression, the root directory. That's the whole thing. In contrast,
name, right?
Exactly, change root. That's the very thing. That's a very topic. In contrast to this, modern day containers bring to the table a little bit more. If we stick to say the likes of Docker, LXC, because LXC is just an extension of LXC, Podman, or any OCI, as an Open Container Initiative compliant API running on Linux, that normally avails of something called control groups and namespaces.
Okay.
Any ideas what these are, Bon?
Yeah, I have control groups there. So you usually refer to as C groups in
yes.
Linux's admin terms. Really about controlling the resources again, or setting limits around them. If you think back to something like NICE, you set a level of prioritization on your process, but you can do C groups is kind of taking that to the whole container idea how I would describe it.
That's exactly it. In combination, rather, with namespaces, they form the basic infrastructure for containers, because what namespaces essentially do in a Linux context, they create, as the name implies, a separate namespace. So that allows you to have more than one process with process identifier, also known as PID, as in PID, 1, 2, 3, 4, living different namespaces. So control groups, as Martin rightly explained, essentially put a level of control about the on the resource usage of a group of processes. And then namespaces take care of the logical separation between different sets of processes that are confined to a single namespace. So these are the two building blocks of modern containers in Linux, meaning that, and this is one of the advantages of, say, using systemd, a process that does a double fork, and details are in the show notes, frantically trying to get away from the TTY controlling it, cannot do so in a control group. That puts an extra level layer of control on the whole notion of a process group, which of course makes administration of said control groups much easier. Because in previous days, especially before systemd, and control groups of course, if a process would do a double fork, it would itself detach it from the controlling terminal, and then it would be free to do whatever it wanted. Especially if the user would log out controlling that terminal, the process would continue to live on. Now, if you shut down a control group, all the processes attached to that control group are essentially gone.
Okay. A question for you. So, namespaces, then what can you separate with namespaces?
Anything including next week's lotto number. Ooh. Yes. Indeed. Kids, for you out there listening, the command is a proper space C groups. Take a look yourself.
Yeah.
No, joke aside, they take care of separating, essentially, or confining anything that is out there, memory, CPU slices, network bandwidth, and all the rest of it. Equally important are namespaces. Current Linux systems since 2.6.19, I think, take care of mounting points, especially binding mount points, IPC abstractions, network abstractions, of course, memory, CPU slices, CPUs and such things. Meaning the combination of these two give you a full control and a full separation of user lands, because these essentially are the mechanisms that you need if you want to separate different execution environments for applications, also known as user lands.
Okay. So going back to the original question, background, what are the benefits of doing this? Compared to people used to virtualize the hardware, right?
It's straightforward. More jobs for system administrators.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Fair enough.
Are there still
any other questions, Mark?
Are there still such people around these days?
Yes, they're called DevOps or DevSecOps or Ops people. Yes.
Ah, okay. I thought Ops people were a dying breed, but
no, they're not, Martin. No, not really. No, jokes aside, of course, that separation has a number of advantages, especially if you take a look at how to package applications. Martin, if you take a look at your infrastructure, you have about 10 web servers driving the the weapons shop.
Huh?
About what? Five of another five looking after the recreational drug thing? No?
I couldn't possibly comment.
I see. But if memory serves correctly, all of these websites have different application ecosystems behind them. So
they generally do indeed. Yeah.
Yes, this is the point.
Hmm.
Whether websites are not people is straightforward. If you take a look at any abstract that is out there at the moment, chances might be, especially if you're looking at prepackaged things, you will have a requirement for Rust 1.48. You will have a requirement for Python 3.9.1. Then the PIP packages come into play. You will have Flask. You will have Pyramid. You will have what's the other Python package I'm looking for? Fast IPA, exactly. But depending on the app stack that uses them, they will all depend on different versions. Same goes for Rust. Now the thing is, with Rust, you do have Cargo, which is a package manager. For the details, listen to the previous episode. With Python, you have things like virtual environments and some other abstractions. But the thing is, these mechanisms only go so far, because if you want to package your apps, you want to use an abstraction that allows these DevOps people, especially these ops people, essentially to take a so-called image package, whatever you want to call it, and simply deploy it. Pretty much like an operating system image that you install that has all the applications packaged with it.
Yeah.
And this is where containers come in. Essentially, with the likes of Docker, which is another favorite or famous container runtime environment, you get so-called images constructed by so-called Docker files. The following explanation essentially uses Docker as just an example. Other container runtimes are, of course, possible. Essentially, if you take a Docker file and then you let Docker build the corresponding image, what Docker then does, it takes a base level operating system user, it takes a base level user land, let's put it this way, not operating system, but user land, and installs and packages the required components in that image. It then defines a starting point, typically a shell script, or an init process, or something comparable to an init process, that starts up the user land, comparable to systemd in modern Linux environments. Then this startup script will take care of starting up the database, of starting up the app server, starting up the Python interpreter if we want to stick to Flask, Pyramid, or Fast API. It may also start a reverse proxy, Nginx, Apache, whatever, to ensure that HTTPS terminated traffic goes the right way and all the rest of it. So essentially what the container does, it creates a user land with the specific applications, with the specific versions of these applications. And this is where the beauty of containers come in. Ready to roll, because essentially once you create this image, all a container runtime now does, it takes this image and creates a user land, transfers control to that user land, and then the web server will start, the database server will start, and any other middleware that is required for this app stack will start within the container. So at the end of the day, you will have a running application ecosystem, including the middleware and the container. The beauty now is that this user land has the exact versions that all of the components require. If you would do this in a normal system, good luck with the resulting complexity. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what containers feature and the benefits come in. Because if you create that image, and then if you subsequently create a container from this image, you have exactly the specified environment for this abstract to run in without interference from the outside. This is one of the main beauties of these isolated inverted commas user land.
Oh, and the other way around as well, right?
Exactly.
Very good.
Needless to say, there are quite a few container runtimes out there. Docker is one of them. Cryo, which essentially is just a stripped down version of Docker to the bare minimum. Podman, LXC already mentioned, and Containerd come to mind. Containerd probably being the emerging standard here.
Mm. LXC is sort of that was slowly being
Canonical pushed it, but it fell by the wayside. I'm afraid with regards to deployment numbers, if current figures are anything to go by. So I reckon we should probably mention the OCI, no?
Okay.
OCI.
Oh, we have mentioned the OCI.
OCI. If you're listening, the email address is sponsor@linuxinlaws.eu. Sending a mail to that email will get you further mentions. Sending cash based on an email that you sent to us will get you beyond mentions. Just get in touch.
Yeah, maybe we should get someone from the OCI on.
Hmm. So that they can plug this properly. Yes.
Yeah.
OCI for listening.
Excellent plan. All right.
feedback/sponsor@linuxinlaws.eu will do the trick nicely. We will guarantee you a speaking slot so that you can plug the technology. And forget about the Kubernetes hipsters. The OCI is essentially the place where it happens. Kubernetes, of course, as we all know, Kubernetes, OpenShift, and all the rest of it is pure marketing. The core is the important thing.
Okay.
Amen. this is the end of my prayer.
Let's not go there.
Why not? Just for the crack of it.
Well, we are hoping to get some
Martin, you're not
guys
implying,
on, aren't we, as well?
Martin, hang on. You're not implying you're not religious.
I'm not replying I'm not religious.
This is tricky, I know, but then please answer. Are you not?
I am not religious. No.
Why? Hang on. Only half of your kid runs proprietary operating systems, no? So that makes you half religious. Okay, I get the point.
Yes.
No, which part of you is religious then?
The left side?
Yes! Excellent choice! Very good. And what are the details, Martin? Apart from Ubuntu.
Sorry, go on.
The details about your religious left side.
Ah.
Yes.
Well, you know, this is all
this,
things.
Okay, we already covered Ubuntu. Maybe communism? Maybe Fedora?
Fedora, no. I never got on with Fedora.
Arch? Socialism?
Socialism, yeah, fine.
Catholic? Orthodox? Something like this?
No.
Sorry, of course you're Dutch.
I am, indeed, yes. Well, there must be some Catholics in all there.
About two? Maybe three?
Yeah, good question. Oh, no. Wait. We have this island. It used to be an island in the, used to be part of the sea in the middle of Holland. And all the people there are some strange religion.
That makes it five. Okay.
It's a couple of thousand, maybe.
In the middle of the sea? What I
said, I don't know if you know the shape of the Netherlands, but
yes, I do.
There's a great big gap in the middle where there's a bunch of water.
Yes,
and that bunch of water used to be bigger, and there used to be islands in it, and then they connected the islands with the rest of the land, so they're no longer islands. But
I thought you sold them.
Sold them?
Yes.
No, I
to the Anglo-Saxons. And No.
We just removed all the water and then we called it land where people could live, which is,
I see. Okay.
Being a small country, we don't have enough land. Yeah.
And of course, the colonies are long gone, fair enough.
That's a good question.
Well, you see, the Netherlands had quite a few colonies, but
I'm just trying to think. There might be some islands left somewhere that are
still under Dutch rule. That would surprise me.
Yeah.
Which ones?
Like Curacao, maybe.
I thought you sold that to the Americans.
No, that was New York. We sold that to the Americans.
No, Peter Stuyvesant never sold this. He just lived there.
Yeah, I know. I think it was kind of it was swapped with Suriname, but yeah, that it wasn't really a real
this
swap.
Is why,
it was more
this
of a,
is,
you should you, we shall have this and you shall have that kind of swap.
This is what I wouldn't consider to be a good deal, but that's my personal interpretation of the matter.
It was classed as a swap, but it clearly wasn't. It was more of a if you don't swap, we'll just take it.
So the swap defaulted essentially. Okay, got it.
Yes.
As swaps normally do.
Yeah. So I wonder if there's any left now. There might be some small islands here and there. Anyway, well, this is the advantage of being connected to the sea. Is that you can go places and just call them your own.
Yes. Whereas people,
being landlocked, you don't have so much opportunity there.
People, if you happen to listen and live on these islands, please send emails for Martin's education to feedback@linuxinlaws.eu so that Martin can finally get around to knowing what the crack is with the current set of Netherlands.
Yeah.
Especially with regards to distribution. Especially with regards to geographical distribution, as in the country where he's from originally. Because apparently the English have brainwashed him to some extent.
Okay. I just don't keep up with all these things. It could be that Suriname became independent ages ago, right? I can't remember. It's,
okay, Martin. It's,
1975, there you go, see. I don't think we have any left now. Yeah.
Too bad. But do you notice anything? We are slowly digressing.
We have digressed.
Yes.
I'm not entirely sure why, but...
Never mind. Back to the container thing, yes.
Container, yes. Where were we? Namespaces, C groups, we've done... So what was the
advantages
that introduced these? Oh, yeah, advantages is what we're talking about.
Yes.
What about the disadvantages?
Complexity.
Why?
You need a container runtime.
Well, that's not complex, is it?
Well, you at least need to install an additional package on your operating system in order to provide the container runtime.
Yes.
And of course, a tiny performance overhead.
Well, there was always a third one, which is why there was resistance from the. Let's call it the sysadmins and what have you, is that the way software used to be developed is that everybody knew what was installed where and what it was doing, etc., etc. And with containers, you just the developers basically just do what they like and say, just run this container.
And what's bad about this? Loss of control?
Yes, the policy admins, yeah. This is loss of job, right?
Not necessarily, because somebody needs...
Well, they need to install the container daemon.
Exactly. Somebody needs an expert who can control that container mayhem. And now a blatant teaser. We will cover in the second part of this 20-part episode on virtualization, I think, maybe, not... We will cover orchestration frameworks like Kubernetes and all the rest of them. But given the fact that containers like Linux won't go away anytime soon, somebody has to control them, to deploy them, to orchestrate them, to scale them, all the rest of it. This is what you cannot do with the simple approaches to infrastructure, like the OCI framework and similar approaches, because you need an additional layer on top of that. Best example, if you have a couple of containers, if you want to scale them up, you have to do this one by one manually if you're not using something like Kubernetes or Friends.
It's not scaling at all. It's also if you run two or the same containers, then how are you going to access them and what are the ports and the routes into them?
Exactly. How do you define the network connectivity between them? How you define the scalability between the different entities and all the rest of it? And without going into the next episode too much, this is where frameworks like Kubernetes come in, because Kubernetes provide an additional layer of abstraction from the individual containers right up to pods, where pods actually define a set of containers, and Kubernetes then will take care of monitoring the health of these containers, making sure that if a container dies, it's going to be restarted. If you want to add additional infrastructure to your pod, you scale this up, and this is just a simple command in Kubernetes. Where if you want to do this manually, good luck with that, because essentially you have to create new containers, you have to provide additional resources to these containers, you have to include them into your network infrastructure and all the rest of it. So that's a very complex approach with doing it manually, in contrast to Kubernetes taking care of this for you more or less automatically. And this is where these additional kind of frameworks come in, but more on that actually in a future episode.
Indeed.
Anything else we should talk about container in the context of containers? Yeah, there are also these metal boxes that can put on chips.
I think just from a practicality point of view, and if you just ignore the development of applications and the deployment of them, there is a sort of everyday advantage to containers, right, where you can just pull down a RabbitMQ container or a Postgres container or a Redis container and just start using it without having to install a bunch of stuff and start using it straight away, because most software will have a container image available on something like Docker Hub, etc. So
that's exactly because of the fact that somebody else did the packaging for you. Exactly it. Yes.
Yes. But as a sort of practical result, it means that, you have a much easier route to running things, excluding BigBlueButton. But yeah, that's a whole different story.
Yes.
Maybe one day.
Yes. Very much so, yes. Because if you want to take something for a spin just to try it out, of course. Blatant plug. For example, Redis probably being the best example. If you wanna take
how is the pull bot doing for increasing the numbers?
Full disclosure, I still happen to work for Redis. Yes. So did Martin before he defected. I'm on that. Okay, no jokes aside. If you take a look at something called Redis modules. Redis modules essentially are a server extension that provide application level functionality to a native Redis instance. So essentially you take a native Redis database NoSQL instance, server instance that is, and then you attach a JSON model. Redis turns into a document type database. If you attach Redis graph
to
Redis, you turn Redis into an open source graph database. If you load the time series module onto Redis, you essentially transform this NoSQL database into a time series database comparable with Influx and other time series databases. The trouble is, of course, that with each and every module, normally, using the generic approach, you would have to take the natural Redis instance, you have to pull down the source code of the module, and then you have to compile it. That's an additional layer of complexity on top of your native Redis deployment. And some modules require the server to be of a specific version or beyond. Of course, all of these modules have individual dependencies in terms of libraries that they're using and all the rest of it. So compiling this manually is a bit of an effort. Thing is that there is a container out there called, I think, Redis Mod, details maybe in the show notes, where that you simply pull down, in terms of the image, pull down the image, and then you have a Redis server running inside a container with all of the modules that Redis, the company, basically, has contributed. That's a major advantage in contrast to kind of doing that yourself in terms of installing Redis natively and then compiling each and every module on your specific platform with the specific requirements that all of these modules require. So that's a lot of effort saved, to put it this way. And that's exactly, and I'm using just this Redis mod container or image as just one example.
It's actually a good example because you touched upon another aspect of containers there, which Redis is very suited to, being ephemeral, right? Or stateless, or
most exactly. If you do not choose, well, this is a Docker detail actually. If you do not tell Docker otherwise, a container image, a container will be gone in terms of the memory attached to a container, especially the file system. Will be gone once you destroy the container, unless you tell Docker, for example, to use a persistent volume, essentially a mount point to the host operating system. Otherwise, normally a Docker container will be gone, including any writes in terms of write operations that any of the applications or processes, rather, to be more precise, in the container did to the container local file system. Mm-hmm. This is what Martin means by ephemeral.
Indeed.
So
yeah, which is why the Redis was a good example.
Exactly. So it's a straightforward way actually, just to take software that you want to try out for a spin, without having to install a multitude of dependencies. Worry about the versions of set dependencies and all the rest of it. You simply pull out the image in Sensei container, and then you're off to the races. You may have to map some ports, but that's as far as it goes.
Yeah, ports, volumes, it depends, right? If you what it is from it, but yeah. Mm. Indeed.
Anything else that we should talk about that we have missed?
I think that's probably a good introduction now.
Oh yeah.
For those people unfamiliar.
for the few people working in a shipyard, a container is also a metal box that you can put stuff into and then put on a ship.
Yes. Do you know what sizes they come in actually?
I think they're standardized. They are ISO containers something. About 200 feet long and 15 feet wide or something, and 2 inches high. I might be wrong.
Yeah, interesting way of shipping things. But yeah.
Full disclosure, this is where flat packs come in. Mm. But that's a whole different story. Details may people or may not be in the show notes. Of course, the hipsters among you listening, there might be a show on app images, flat packs, and snaps. Or maybe not.
Did we not do one? Yeah.
Maybe you have done this and are just basically forgetting things. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
Details maybe or may not be in the show. May not,
yes. On a final note, is that why they call Docker?
What do you mean?
Well, you know what a Docker is, don't you?
A container runtime? It may also have some shady meaning that, of course, that I'm not privy to.
No? Well, no. All the analogies are around containers and ships.
You mean a Docker meaning somebody working on a dock at a dock on a dock in the
yes,
in a
and
dock
I don't something. Mean yes. Ladies of loose virtue.
What Martin refers to is dames of negotiable affection. Which are the dockers, of course, because they do not dock. Very important.
Indeed. Yeah. Yes, so there we go.
Martin, yes, and of course, we should do the pockets before we... Yes.
Okay, go on then. Why don't you start?
Any OCI compliant Docker any OCI compliant container runtime will do. No, jokes aside, I recently discovered that actually From Dusk Till Dawn does have a TV series.
Okay.
As in the movies probably ring a bell. Details of course on the show notes.
Yeah. Okay.
Dusk Till Dawn does Martin, that's a cult movie. Or movie franchise.
Okay.
Don't miss out on the first part.
What's the genre?
True stories from the past.
Okay.
Subtitle: Why Vampires Are Real.
Yes. Okay.
You can't. you haven't seen the original movie called From Dusk Till Dawn. Are you serious?
I don't know. This is.
Quentin apparently wrote the script.
1922 came out.
You're talking about kind of late 90s, early 2000s or something.
No, apparently the original Dusk Till Dawn was 1922. There we go.
I'm talking about the Mexican titty bar built upon an ancient burial site as a temple.
Okay. Definitely not seen that. No,
you must check it out, Martin. It's. Okay. I mean, if you think that Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction are great, don't. I mean, you must check out From Dusk Till Dawn. Forget about the sequel and forget about the third part. They are not important, but the original one is the must see.
Okay.
Because okay, it's a little bit of a splatter movie, but it has Quentin written all over it in terms of the humor and stuff.
Okay, fair enough.
It's almost as good as Pulp Fiction.
Right.
And there's a spin-off in the shape of a TV series that is. Okay, in terms of almost as good as the first installment of that franchise.
Fair enough.
And what's your POX, Martin?
My POX is... good question. I haven't really had much chance to...
What about a proper Cat 6 cabling? Especially being run underground.
Ah, yes. Oh, that's not a recent one. That's I did that a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Okay. But it's still holding up.
Yes, why not? Yeah.
Excellent. So Martin's POX of the week would be good Dutch craftsman work, especially if done in the former UK.
That's fair enough. Yeah.
As in United Kingdom, of course, which is now just not even a kingdom, but that's another different story.
No, it would be a queendom, surely. Yeah, not a kingdom.
Well, a queendom? Is there such a thing as a queendom, I wonder?
Well, there should be, because it's run by the queen, surely.
But only for the last, what, 60 years, 70 years, something like this?
This year is an anniversary, I think.
Martin, you live there, I do not.
I've got a vague recollection that we get an extra day off or something.
This is how Martin remembers national holidays. Yeah, it was a day off for a
day. No, it hasn't happened yet. I think it's...
it will happen, okay.
Sure, it's... sure, it's this year when there's a... that's Platinum Jubilee, is it? Yes.
Martin, you live there, I do not.
Platinum Jubilee, there you go.
That's but nice. It's important.
Yeah, it's 100 years.
Important okay. enough to get a day off, fair enough.
Yeah, it's 70 years this year, yeah. Rain.
So she's been powerful for the last 70 years, okay. Never mind.
Although she's not doing too well recently, but there we go.
Yeah, never mind. Members of her family defecting in one way or another, but that's a different story, of course. Mm.
Yes.
Harry, if you're listening, you know what I mean, right?
Well, there was a president as well. A president, not the president, but a precedent. Sorry.
Well, the president has defected too. Okay, didn't know that you had a president, but hey, what do I know?
No, the other one back in the 30s who went on to marry a common American woman, whatever his name was.
I think that was before Queen Elizabeth II took reign.
Yeah, but he was basically also a defector who went to shack up with an American female.
As you do, exactly.
It's a bit of a theme there.
It is, if you want to get in touch with us, the first consultation is always free. The email address is martinvisrek@linuxinlaws.eu. One of your subjects might get back to you. And it's not me, no.
Yes, I guess I won't be getting a telegram from her. Yeah, that's for sure.
Probably not, no. Okay, anything yes. else that we should... Yeah, of course, we should mention probably Hacker Public Radio.
Oh, yes.
And if you're listening, thank you for hosting us.
Hope you enjoyed the Gitti episode on static.
That was about 4 years ago, Ken. But don't worry about it.
Has he given up?
No sweat. Ken, you'll find that episode actually in the back catalog. Don't worry about it. Okay. With that, I think that brings us to the end of the episode. People, thank you for listening and speak to you soon.
Bye-bye.
This is the Linux In-Laws.
You come for the knowledge.
But stay for the madness.
Thank you for listening.
This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for their song Salute Margaret, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts.
How come that is the bank holiday?
Because it's the early May bank holiday. It happens every year, the first Monday in May is the bank holiday.
Why?
Because it's May and people like to have a holiday.
A cunning scheme to get procreation going in terms of more taxpayers.
I think it was something to do with Labor Day in the past, but then it got...
have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.